From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 692, VPNs in the Pandemic with guest Richard Hicks, recorded Thursday, April 16th, 2020. Run As Radio is produced each week by Sound Thoughts LLC. For more information, visit soundthoughtsllc.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. This is our next episode in the pandemic series, talking specifically about subjects and materials that can help you as an IT professional working in this pandemic scenario and dealing with all of the complex issues around that. And I'm bringing back to the show Richard Hicks, who is an enterprise mobility expert and the founder and principal consultant of Richard M. Hicks Consulting. His focus is on helping organizations large and small implement Windows 10 always on VPN, Direct Access, and PKI. Richard has more than 25 years of experience working in large-scale corporate computing environments. He has designed and deployed secure remote access solutions for some of the largest companies in the world. And Richard has produced a video training series on Pluralsight and is the author of Implementing Direct Access with Windows Server 2016 by Apress Media. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you for having me. Great to talk to you again.
You know, VPN was always important, but it's crazy important right now.
That is an understatement. Yeah. No question. I have long argued that having an enterprise mobility strategy is critical to supporting business, but never has it been more important or highlighted, I guess, than in today's world and based on current events.
And you and yours are well.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Been surviving fine. I find we all have a few more cycles here for checking in with each other too, because all we have is this sort of narrow pipe of communication, and it's good to just sort of touch base and like, My family's well. In some ways, we're so fortunate to be in IT and used to working from home that a lot of these things that are new for many people are normal for us.
Yes. Yeah. No question. I mean, having been in the mobility space for many, many years now, this is the standard, right? So I have not worked in an office in more than a decade. Yeah. I don't think I could go back.
Yeah. You may not be employable anymore, right?
that's for sure. That would be a showstopper right there, right? No, we'd love to have you work for us, but you'll have to come to the office. No, I can't do that. But yeah, so it's the norm, but now that everyone's doing it, it's really interesting to see how it works. Heck, I've even had grandkids over at the house, and my granddaughter is on a Zoom meeting with her classroom, and she's just sitting at her little desk, and she's raising her hand on the Zoom video, and it's fantastic to watch modern technology, being leveraged for a really fantastic cause at this time.
I do think it's going to be somewhere in this story arc, maybe not this month, but next, to just talk about how distance learning is growing too, and that it, I don't think it's acceptable that we get through this, but that we're better for it.
No question. No question. I think there will be some silver linings to come out of this. I mean, obviously it's a very dark time, but there are going to be some positive aspects of that. And I think one of those is going to be that corporate America is now going to wake up and really understand the importance of a telework strategy, understanding that enterprise mobility is not just a nice to have for those fortunate few that want to work from home, that it is essential and vital to the business, that it's going to now be front and center in a business continuity and disaster recovery plan. Whereas I think before, I think the concept, and I'll back up for just a second, I used to work for a very large bank here in the United States, and I was, we did our BCDR stuff every year, and we went through all the scenarios, and most of them were physical events, earthquake, tornado, floods, fires, those types of things. What happens when this building is uninhabitable due to, a variety of natural causes? But global pandemic, I don't think, was ever one of those considerations where all of your infrastructure is fully 100% intact and fully operational, and yet no one can work there.
Yeah, you just can't go.
I don't think that ever crossed anybody's minds. No. And so now everybody had to go home, and now people are struggling to work in this environment. What I think is going to happen is that, again, corporate America is going to realize, hey, most of my employees were still working and still productive. And by the way, they're probably more productive. There's been study after study after study that shows that employees who work from home are more productive. They're generally happier and more well-adjusted. They have a better work-life balance. And it's all around positive. And then, of course, you go and talk about the net gains for the business, you know, reduced physical presence and all that goes along with that. There's just tremendous benefits to this. And I think that there's a lot of organizations that were hesitant to do that for a variety of reasons. And most of those, I think, you know, were mostly, you know, managerial. They're yeah. the human aspects of wanting to see people or wanting to physically be around people is not a necessity for most people to be productive. And I think that this was a fantastic, quote unquote, experiment for it.
Yeah, an experiment definitely forced on us, but it is necessary.
But in the end, I think a lot of organizations are going to go, hey, when we start putting people back in these buildings, maybe we don't have to have everybody back.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe those people now who might have had long commutes, who probably put up with it for years or decades, are now going to go, hey, I could do everything from home anyway. So why do I need to do this?
Yeah. And I made my milestones, right? Like I delivered on the things you need to, even though Absolutely. We are functioning in an incredibly distracted state because there's Yep. so much going on.
Absolutely. And I agree. Yeah.
It's fascinating. So as this hit your business, what were the calls you were getting? Like what you are front and center on this connectivity problem. So, you know, who called first?
I am definitely not a non-essential worker.
Yeah, no kidding.
I have been absolutely slammed since this kind of went down early mid-March or so. And the bulk of the calls, to be honest with you, were really centered around organizations that had some sort of enterprise mobility in place, whether right. that was direct access or always on VPN, whether it was something like Cisco or Palo Alto Global Protect, what have you. It was mm-hmm. a lot of different things. But the bottom line was is that as soon as they started pushing all these users home, then they ran into scalability issues. They ran into capacity issues. Mm-hmm. Many of these infrastructures performed poorly simply because of poor design or poor implementation choices that were never exposed because they were so underutilized.
Right.
But now under heavy utilization, things began to fall apart. No redundancy so that when a server went down, now everybody was dead. So a lot of that. And then, of course, it also put a tremendous strain, what I have found, on underlying infrastructure resources. I have done a number of PKI deployments from the ground up.
Interesting.
For organizations who were, you know, relying on PKI and certificate authentication for devices and users, and the infrastructure was not capable of supporting that. And so I've done a lot of work around just shoring up PKI and implementing new PKI to support that. So a lot of that has just been simply around, I guess, lack of foresight and a lot of mobility solutions are implemented very tactically, right?
Right.
We need a small subset of our organization to work from remote locations. We have field sales folks. So I'm going to expect 50 or 100 of those people of my 1,000 or 1,500
right.
person organization to be outside. And so they do it for them. And then in this hits the wall. And then they just send everybody home and let everybody use it, and it falls over. So
sure.
Just a lack of foresight and planning in with that regard. So
well, my experience with VPN implementations is that they weren't stressed, so you've never needed to optimize it. It's always been good enough mm-hmm. and fast enough, and suddenly now it's not. So what tips over first? Is it bandwidth? Is it compute? Is it network configuration? Like what hurts?
All of the above, but most often it just exposes either some poor design practices or it just simply not enough capacity, not enough provision capacity.
Right.
So, you know, you're expecting, you know, 50 or 100 users on a small deployment and all of a sudden you have 1,000 and you just didn't have enough CPU and memory to support it.
Right.
Or in some cases, you might have done the right thing where you had redundancy, you had two servers.
Right.
But when one server fell over because of the load, then of course, all of that load goes onto the first server, which the two servers couldn't handle too. Which the first one goes. So just not enough redundancy or not enough capacity in those cases. Certainly bandwidth and throughput has been some of the limitations. I've helped a few customers implement new load balancers, and most of them were, some of them were new deployments, some of them were just license upgrades because, you know, they went with the small version, you know, they went with the 100 megabit or the, you know, 200 megabit, platform when they really need the 500 or the full gig, those types of things. Those definitely got exposed over the last few months.
And those sound like relatively easy fix to adjust a configuration, to call the vendor and say, open the pipe up, to buy the larger license. Like, I would think that's good news.
Of course. In some of those scenarios, yes, but some of them were fundamental design flaws in where, you know, where resources were located, how they were configured. Some of them involved fundamental changes to the configuration that were deeply architectural in that really you end up having to do almost an entire redesign. Many customers who were on older platforms using legacy technologies like Direct Access just found that it, even under the capacity with enough resources behind it, it still wasn't meeting their needs. And so they moved, they needed to move to something more modern that provided better throughput and better performance. And so generally speaking, those are kind of things we've been seeing over the last month or so.
Now, last time we were having a show, I mean, a lifetime ago, it seems now, because how much things have changed. We were talking about the sort of end of life of Direct Access. Has Microsoft backed away from that under the circumstances?
Not to my knowledge. Microsoft's formal public stance on Direct Access is that they will be supporting it through the life cycle of Windows Server 2019.
Okay.
So we have 10 years. It's got a fair runway left, but it's not obviously infinite. Organizations that have Direct Access deployed are, you know, I mean, there's no pressing need to move off of it. It's not going to stop working, you know, next week, next month, next year. It is beginning to show its ages. And by that, I mean, there have been no new features or functionality added to Direct Access since Server 2012.
Right.
So even though it is brand new, it's in Server 2019, it really is an old technology. It is a legacy technology, and it has those requirements that are, you know, again, for organizations that meet these requirements, things like on-premises Active Directory and group policy management and domain join machines. Mm-hmm. Then it still works, but it just doesn't really provide the, you know, modern integration with things like Azure AD and multi-factor authentication, conditional access, all of those sorts of things that you get from modern cloud technology. So it still works. It's, again, showing its age just in terms of the fact that it hasn't gotten a lot of love in the last, five plus years. But at the end of the day, it's still working and still functioning still beating. And I still have customers that have it and like it, but I'm certainly not doing a lot of new deployments for Direct Access.
No.
That has definitely gone the way of the modern implementations of always on VPN and a variety of third parties as well.
Yeah. So I got to think, if you're starting from scratch right now, you look at always on VPN, how would you weigh that against a Cisco AnyConnect, which I guess is the largest in this space?
Certainly. I think Cisco AnyConnect, Palo Alto Global Protect are probably two of the big players there. Mm-hmm. NetMotion Mobility from NetMotion Software is a fantastic solution that's kind of software-based that is extremely compelling. But at the end of the day, you're right. I have customers that are migrating away from Direct Access and looking at, you know, what always-on VPN offers. And a lot of them are taking a kind of a step back to evaluate what always on VPN offers and what its shortcomings and limitations are and how they're addressed by third party solutions.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of the day, always on VPN is good. It does provide more of a kind of a base level of functionality. The real advanced capabilities come from some of these third parties and some of the things that you can do with that in terms of security and performance and so forth. But I'll be honest with you, going back to what we talked about with the pandemic here, I have done a number of deployments, both always on VPN, NetMotion, Palo Alto as well, for customers who simply didn't want to spend any more time, effort, or energy shoring up Direct Access.
Sure.
When it was already falling over, they just said, if we're going to pay you to come in here and do this, why put siding on the house when we really need a new foundation? And so, in those
just
scenarios,
roll out
I've
something
done a
new
number of deployments for that. Yeah, absolutely. Well, again, they're spending the time. They're going to go through some pain. Why don't we at least get get something more modern rather than have to do this again in 6 months or a year or whatever.
So if I'm hearing correctly, it's like if Direct Access is working for you, stay with it. But if it's tipping over or it's struggling for whatever reason, then there's a bunch of choices here. But I would imagine the same thing that would, well, is always on more efficient. Like, could I repurpose it? If I was taking a Direct Access set of hardware and repurposing was always on, would I have more success or do I need new gear?
You would most definitely have more success.
Okay.
The fundamental user experience and the administrative experience is almost identical between Direct Access and Always On VPN. Always On VPN is seamless, transparent, and always on, just like Direct Access was.
Right.
The advantages that it provides are, of course, that it integrates with modern services, cloud services like Azure AD. You can integrate it with, you can use conditional access policies for remote access. You can sign in with Azure AD authentication. There's a variety of things that you can do. It's managed by Intune and so forth. So those are all very compelling features and capabilities. What I really like about Always On VPN when you're comparing it to Direct Access is that it is infrastructure independent. And like we talked about on the last call, mm-hmm. Direct Access is great, but it is very tightly coupled with your infrastructure and specifically with Active Directory and group policy. And there are things that you can do that are seemingly benign in AD that would absolutely hose Direct Access. Always On VPN, I guess, much less tightly coupled, and so it's more insulated from a lot of those infrastructure changes. So you can actually deploy Always On VPN and literally swap out the back-end infrastructure rather than the clients ever knowing it. And with Direct Access, that was prohibitively difficult to do. Direct Access didn't even like sometimes when you changed an IP address on a server.
Yeah.
But with Always On VPN, it's much more flexible with regards to that.
Tolerant all that. And you already own the license for it if you own those server licenses. So in terms of having to go and buy product.
That's the fundamental driving factor with Always On VPN. And it was with Direct Access as well. When you're comparing those to third parties, with a third party solution, if you're going to adopt NetMotion software or Palo Alto GlobalProtect or something like that, you have to acquire that software.
Yeah.
There's a license fee for it. It's per user or per device.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably a maintenance cost. Sometimes there's subscription services that'll include all of that. But with Always On VPN and Direct Access, you own the licenses.
Yeah.
Because it's just part of the operating system.
Yeah.
And so at the end of the day, I have many customers who opt for, Direct Access or Always On VPN simply because it is extremely cost effective. It scales effectively and very well. And they're not, if they don't need many of those advanced features and capabilities, then they're willing to settle for a solution that provides more of a base level of functionality because they just simply don't have those advanced requirements.
Absolutely. And I'm going to interrupt you for one moment here for this very important message. Don't panic. You don't have to spin up or add to your VPN to get real Windows 10 management to your remote work computers. With Policy Pack and an internet connection, you already have all you need. If you use Group Policy, have an MDM service like Intune, or even no infrastructure at all, Policy Pack has you covered to handle the real remote work challenges you have right now for Windows 10. With Policy Pack MDM or Policy Pack Cloud, you get the power to manage applications and browsers on Windows 10, overcome application UAC prompts, block unknownware, dynamically configure the Windows 10 start screen, taskbar, and file associations. As a bonus, you can use Policy Pack to deliver any real on-prem group policy and group policy preferences settings to your remote work machines for the security and configuration they need. Learn how thousands of other admins enhance their remote work scenarios. Come to policypack.com/remotework to learn more. That's policypack.com/remotework. Policy Pack, securing your standards. Listeners to this podcast are eligible to win a free copy of the Cybex Wiley book entitled MDM Fundamentals, Security, and the Modern Desktop, using Intune, Autopilot, and Azure to manage, deploy, and secure Windows 10 by Jeremy Moskowitz, Enterprise Mobility MVP. Simply pick Run As Radio in the drop-down when you visit policypack.com/remotework. Good luck, and we hope you win. And we're back. It's Richard Campbell. This is the Run As Radio in the pandemic series, and I'm talking to my friend Richard Hicks about VPNs in the time of pandemic and all of the issues around that. The one reason I could see not ending up with always on or direct access for that matter, if the hardware is not able to cope with it, is it's really hard to buy new hardware right now.
No question. And I think this goes back to one of the advantages of software-based solutions is that they run on Windows Server.
Right.
Right. So selling point for direct access and always on VPN is that you you can spin up a virtual machine in your existing on your existing hypervisor, be that Hyper-V, VMware, what have you. Doesn't really matter. You can spin it up. You install the software. You configure it. It works.
Yeah.
You need more capacity. You just spin up virtual machines. You know, that is more restrictive when you're looking at solutions like Cisco, Palo Alto, some of the others, because they have proprietary operating systems. And of course, they usually work active or active passive, depending on how that works.
And if you want to scale that, you have to buy more of their hardware.
You have to buy more of their hardware. If you're doing it in a virtual environment, you have to buy the licenses that unlock the additional, you know, the additional throughput.
Right.
This is where solutions that, and I'm always looking for advantages like this, solutions like NetMotion Mobility, for example, runs on Windows Server. So it provides all of those direct access benefits in terms of seamless, transparent, always on, but it runs on Windows Server. So if I need two servers or 20 servers, I just spin up the virtual machines.
Yeah.
They have a subscription license that allows you to just drop that on there and spin up as many VMs as you want. And so you have this nearly infinite flexibility and scalability. So I always look for solutions like that. There's others out there, but that one seems to be one of the best.
And no, I really appreciate that.
Ultimately, what we're looking for is deployment flexibility. We don't really try to not lock in our customers to, you know, to difficult solutions to scale out and scale up and so forth. So those solutions generally work very well in that regard.
Yeah, because you know you're always going to be able to buy the software and certainly buy additional licenses. But if I'm dealing with a set of hardware and I don't have any more hardware available to me, I can't get in enough time. I could even see shutting down less important VMs to free up resources to be able to scale the VPN side enough that people can do what they need to do.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely.
Do you get into a case where you're starting to advise what not to pass through the VPN? I've had conversations with folks who are saying, hey, we switched up to OneDrive for Business to stop sharing files through the VPN.
Mm-hmm. So, yes, this is a rather salient point given current events is that when customers started moving all of their employees home, those that were still using forced tunneling found themselves in an absolute world of hurt.
Wow.
So forced tunneling, for the audience, for the uninitiated, they may not be familiar with what we're talking about here. Let me back up just a sec.
Yeah.
The tunneling modes, there are two tunneling modes when we're talking about VPN, forced tunnel and split tunnel. Forced tunnel is where you bring all of the client's traffic over the VPN tunnel, including all of their internet browsing, everything. A split tunnel only routes traffic that is bound for the internal corporate network over the tunnel. Everything else goes directly to the internet. So you need to get to that file server or access that domain controller to log on. That goes over the tunnel.
Right.
You're going to browse a Microsoft website or a news website or what have you. That just goes straight to the internet. Now, The notion of forced tunneling was common in the 80s and 90s. Today, it is an antiquated solution that I think people would do very well to reconsider if they're still using it today. Using forced tunneling is really challenging in today's world because it ends up causing more problems than it solves. The idea behind forced tunneling for administrators is that I'm responsible for, you know, everything that happens on this laptop. I want to make sure that everything that they're doing is monitored, logged, and, you know, filtered by my on-premises gateway.
Right.
So I tunnel all of their traffic so that it egresses my, you know, on-premise gateway, and I have full control over that. But again, like I said, that is a very antiquated notion in today's world.
Yeah.
The drawbacks to that are, first and foremost, the amount of traffic that gets backhauled over a VPN is prohibitively challenging, especially at scale.
Yeah.
So it requires much more in terms of ISP links and bandwidths. It requires much more resources. By the way, the user experience is quite poor because now what you've done is you've broken all of their CDNs, right? None of the CDNs work because wherever you are, your traffic appears to come from wherever your firewall is on premises, right? So all of the CDN stuff's broken. So all of your web traffic is going to be taking suboptimal paths. By the way, most of the internet is encrypted now, and your VPN is encrypted. So you're basically encrypting encrypted traffic, which adds protocol overhead, reduces throughput, introduces latency. It's just a downward cycle that's just really bad.
I wonder if it's one of those configuration things you might be bit with right up front when you went, you had an old VPN that was only used for a handful of users. Now you suddenly scaled it up. If you're still doing forced tunneling, like, you can get a lot of performance out of turning that off.
You bet. You bet. And then, of course, when we start talking about system updates, patch management, and you have thousands of machines in the field and they're all downloading updates from your, you know, on-premises SCCM servers all over the VPN, plus all their internet traffic, and they're all watching, you know, YouTube videos and listening to Spotify and God knows what else they're doing over your VPNs, right? Sure, you're controlling and monitoring that, but at the end of the day, you're still responsible for hauling that traffic over your VPN, and it's just poor all the way around. So with split tunneling, which is the recommended model today, the number one pushback I get back is from administrators is, okay, well, I still have to control access on this client. I can't have them browsing the bad sites. If they do, I want to know about it. If they're talking to command and control servers, I absolutely want to know about it. My answer and the real solution to that is some sort of in-place security mechanism to do that. Many solutions are available today. There are many cloud gateways out there. There are many other security filtering solutions that are out there. The most common, I think, are probably like a Zscaler, Cisco Umbrella. These are things that allow you to enforce acceptable use policy on your clients wherever they are. So it means you can do split tunneling, but you give up nothing in terms of visibility and control. And so anytime you're looking at doing split tunneling, again, you're still responsible for the security posture of these clients. You want to make sure that they're healthy and that they're not doing the bad things. Look at those solutions because they can really help those organizations who are moving away from forced tunneling to split tunneling still maintain visibility and control over those endpoints.
Totally makes sense. And yeah, great catch that that could be a problem, especially with an older setup, because obviously anything you set up new now is going to split tunnel pretty much by default. What other offloads, things we can do to improve performance and decrease load overall?
Well, certainly, with split tunneling, it also means that all of our update traffic has the ability just to go right out to Microsoft. Certainly for those organizations that are, you know, have on-premises Active Directory and domain join clients in the field, they still want that visibility of it. Of course, you know, with SCCM, you have things like the Cloud Management Gateway, which means, it gives you that ability to still control all of the system updates, patching, and so forth. Still gives you full visibility and reporting and whatnot, but ultimately all of those updates just come down directly from Microsoft over the user's connection, native internet connection. So that's tremendously helpful.
Yeah.
But in terms of that, other than that, I think those are the big ones. I mean, I think that there are some opportunities to, to look at other types of traffic that you could either exempt. And by the way, for those listening, there are going to be times when you absolutely have to tunnel traffic over the VPN, and it's just going to be simply unavoidable. I have done this a number of times in the past few weeks and over the months where, you have split tunneling, but when my users are in the field, they need to log into some application that is expecting to come from on-premises.
Right.
And so we can selectively tunnel that traffic. And by the way, some solutions are better at this than others, but we have the ability to selectively tunnel that traffic and say, hey, listen, for this particular site or entity or what have you, this resource, go ahead and route that over the tunnel because it does need to appear to come from on-premises so that it comes from that your organization's trusted IP or trusted network or something like that. That way it avoids having, to do multi-factor authentication or even it's just an ACL thing where you can't get to it from the outside world. In those scenarios, I think you'll find that those things will be helpful.
I bet we're discovering a whole bunch of those right now as we've moved people that have never worked from home before.
No question. And the opposite is true. So I have customers who still insist on forced tunnel. And by the way, there may be compelling reasons to do that.
Yeah.
I think that the advantages are outweighed by the disadvantages of that. But there are organizations that for one reason or another either insist on it or just have to because that's the way it's done. Microsoft has released guidance for using. And by the way, let me back up. Forced tunneling as a technology means everything comes over the tunnel. And with regards to always on VPN and direct access, that was pretty exclusive, meaning there was no option to exempt anything. When you set up forced tunneling, that was it. third parties do give you the ability to selectively exempt traffic. For example, NetMotion, Palo Alto, Cisco, many others allow you to say, I want to do forced tunneling, but I want to exempt all of my Office 365 traffic. And I can do that by using the domain. You know, there's a couple of domains that are associated with that, and you just exempt those from the rule, and it works. Always on VPN doesn't do that, unfortunately. And neither does Direct Access, but Microsoft did just release guidance for a workaround that they have that does allow you to exempt Office 365 traffic from always-on VPN if you insist on forced tunneling. You can go to my website or the Microsoft website and find that information.
Sure.
But there's they've published some detailed guidance for getting that configured.
That's awesome. What about the Azure VPN-related products? If folks are, you know, I'm talking to lots of people right now that were playing with cloud migration things, and suddenly there's a lot more energy for that.
You bet. So in Microsoft Azure specifically, we have a couple of different offerings, and there's a number of ways to do VPN in the cloud in Azure. Specifically, you have the Azure VPN Gateway, which was traditionally used for site-to-site connectivity,
right.
But it does have the capability of supporting point-to-site. That point-to-site VPN can be used by Windows 10 VPN clients.
Nice.
And it is an effective solution for always-on VPN. It has its own limitations, some rather serious ones, so I don't necessarily recommend it. But it does work, and in some cases, it might be a good alternative. You can deploy Windows Server routing and remote access servers in Azure, but the irony of ironies is that it is not a supported workload in Azure. If you go to the Microsoft website and you go to the supported Windows Server workloads for Azure, Direct Access, routing, and remote access are listed as not supported. Now, here's the deal. Not supported is very different than doesn't work.
Right.
I actually deploy RRes in Azure on a regular basis, and customers are willing to forego the formal support because of the advantages it provides. If you're looking for a formally supported solution, obviously the Azure VPN Gateway is the choice. And then, of course, third-party virtual network appliances certainly can be used. So I've deployed a variety of solutions using the Azure Marketplace appliances. Same thing in Amazon AWS as well, where you spin up the vendors, you know, Cisco or Palo Alto or whoever has their solution available as an appliance, and you can use those in the cloud as well.
Awesome. Yeah.
And then finally, Azure Virtual WAN looks to be quite interesting. I don't have a lot of experience with it yet, but Azure Virtual WAN looks like it's going to be quite compelling in terms of not only branch office support, but for client-based VPN and specifically for always-on VPN, a much, much more scalable solution. And so that one's showing some interesting promise as well.
So after getting over this initial fire, getting your people working from home, and now you're trying to improve performance and so forth, there's some new technologies coming down the pipe here that might actually help us.
Well, yeah. So, and some of them actually aren't necessarily even VPNs. So,
right.
You know, if we're thinking ahead, the VPN may not be around forever, at least as popular as it is today. Because obviously, as we march towards the cloud and organizations rapidly adopt cloud infrastructure and services and so forth, the need for traditional remote access, meaning access to on-premises data and applications, is becoming much less. You know, so many services are available as cloud services. Many organizations are adopting things like OneDrive for Business and SharePoint and whatnot, where most of your applications and data are available via public interfaces. And so the need for an always-on VPN or any VPN service does tend to naturally diminish. Now, that being said, at the end of the day, the need for the VPN will still be around because for a variety of reasons, not everyone in the world is ever going to be able to migrate entirely to the cloud.
Yeah.
Many organizations are going to hang on to their on-premises infrastructure and may have a significant investment in Active Directory and the domain and domain joined devices because that's what they choose or what have you. And for a variety of reasons. And so the VPN will still be around in many respects to support those types of things. But yeah, as we start looking to the cloud, we're talking about, you know, more, you know, web-based applications, There's a lot of things that are coming online. For example, Microsoft's Secure Hybrid Access, which is an Azure offering that integrates with third-party solutions like F5 and Citrix and a variety of others, Akamai, that allow you to publish even legacy applications via the cloud. So by legacy applications, I mean things that were traditionally heavy client-server, TCP access, Kerberos authentication, those types of things, non-web-based applications that they can make available over these solutions. So in that regard, you know, the landscape is changing, but, you know, I don't think it'll ever go away permanently, but it's certainly evolving for sure.
Yeah. Well, and I'm also going to make separate shows around virtual desktops, but I think the hybrid access story is one of those things where it's like, hey, we can't move off of this app. It's killing us over the VPN. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is a better solution.
Yeah, no question.
Very interesting. Yeah. Richard, always a pleasure to talk to you. The circumstances, of course, are unusual. But thank goodness you're around. We certainly need your services these days. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Mine too. And thanks so much for listening to Run As Radio. And we'll talk to you next time.